Hey, welcome back. So we have a long two lectures ahead of us today. We are going to get started off continuing with the traffic engineering ideas, which we briefly overviewed in the last class. In the remaining part of the two lectures today, we'll be looking at how to design high-speed routers. Okay, what are the challenges in high-speed routing and how do we design them? And these topics set the stage for optical networking later on. Okay. Anyway, so traffic engineering, just to review, is that aspect of network engineering which deals with performance optimization of operational networks. Okay, so you are essentially dealing with somebody who is making money off the network. Okay, so that means I'm talking about an internet service provider, not necessarily a corporate network. Corporate network views network as a cost center. Okay, just like they view most of the IT, whereas a service provider views it as a profit center. So anybody who views it as a profit center will not only try to reduce costs, but also gain the maximum leverage with that network, right? So they would like to offer as much services as possible, etc. Okay, so this is the broad motivation for traffic engineering. Okay, so but traffic engineering today is being applied in a broader light for other reasons, and we shall cover that later in different classes. Okay, so basically the two problems, sub-problems to simplify traffic engineering are as simple as this. The operator needs to be able to define a traffic aggregate, okay, and then map the traffic aggregate to a path. It's as simple as that, okay. And so they need to be able to independently define paths in their network, and they need to be able to define traffic aggregates and be able to flexibly map the two, okay. And they need flexibility both in the capabilities of finding different types of paths with protection, etc., as well as being able to define traffic aggregates of varying granularities and quality of service, etc. Okay, now the problem is that in today's routing protocols like OSPF and BGP, one of the major constraints is that they offer only a single path. Okay, it might be a single shortest path, but still it's a single path. Okay, now which means that you cannot have alternate paths. Okay, so as I mentioned, you can have in a single path paradigm or single shortest path in this case, if A to E goes via B and D, A to D also will be forced to go. That's one of the constraints of a shortest path. The subset of a shortest path is also a shortest path. If you change the metrics of the links, you can remap the traffic, okay, but you will remap both these pieces of traffic. You cannot manage traffic in a fine granularity like this. That is, map one flow here and the other flow here. Okay, so I think we looked at it in the last class. Essentially, the problem is that the only degree of freedom that OSPF and BGP allow you to do is to work within the constraints of the single path paradigm, whether it's a shortest path or a single policy defined path. And then you can tweak parameters of OSPF. In this case, link weights is a tunable parameter at the hands of the ISP. Similarly, in BGP, there are a whole bunch of parameters like local pref, there is a MED setting, and so on and so forth. Okay, if you want to understand all the gory details of parameters of BGP, take internet protocols, okay, or go to my website, there's a lecture on that. Okay, so these are limitations. Okay, now there are also other subtle aspects of the single path restriction. So because you are coupling the problem of mapping traffic to a single shortest path or single path, essentially, whenever you want to change the mapping of traffic, you'll also have to change the path. Okay, what this means is, and the way you change a path is by sending around routing announcements like LSAs and so on, or you need to send particular updates in the case of BGP. So you are actually going to generate control traffic from the routing perspective, lots of them. Okay, and it could also lead to instability if one set of control traffic actually triggers another set of control traffic, and you cannot keep your lid on this kind of worms which you open up. Okay, so this can cause a lot of routing instability. Okay, and as recently as last year, people are still fighting to have some degree of control over OSPF and BGP. Okay, and they're probably winning the war against OSPF to be able to control the traffic as well as be able to converge quickly under new circumstances, but BGP is still an open question. Okay, so if you want to sort of look at it at the essence, traffic mapping in OSPF is coupled, the function of traffic mapping is coupled to the function of finding a route or the availability of a route. So an MPLS or an explicit route approach decouples that. Okay, that's the primary idea. Okay, and essentially what you do in MPLS or a label switching approach is to explicitly choose a route. Okay, now in MPLS, not only do you explicitly choose it, you actually explicitly signal the route. You have to go and set up the route. Okay, so that's an extra degree of restriction. And then that path which you signal, or the route you signal, need not be the shortest path. You can take an alternate path which I denote here as a traffic engineered path, and essentially you engineer traffic, or you map the traffic to show up on those paths. Okay, in this case I have grouped traffic by destination prefix. So I'm saying that all the traffic or the traffic aggregate which is bound to this destination, this /24 prefix or this /16 prefix, is mapped to these paths. Okay, so this is as simple as it. Form a traffic aggregate. In this case, I form a traffic aggregate in terms of the destination prefix. There are other ways of forming traffic aggregates, and then you can map them here. For example, I could filter and form a traffic aggregate based on not only the destination address but also the source address, or based upon the application. Maybe I want to give a special privilege to multimedia traffic, or maybe interactive traffic, etc. So these are all filtering or classification decisions that are done at the edge of the network, and then that traffic aggregate is identified and mapped over here. Okay, so the mechanism that MPLS provides to denote a traffic aggregate is called forwarding equivalence class. Okay, and if you just look at this word, it obviously means traffic aggregate. Okay, essentially it says this class of traffic is equivalent for the purposes of forwarding, which means you're mapped to the same path. Okay, that's what it means. So that's about it. So when a packet shows, when packets show up and you have identified some bunch of packets, in this case I'm aggregating these two packets to go on a single path, or in this case a single LSP, I append the same label on these fellows and they go. Obviously there'll be, the labels will be swapped, but essentially even in spite of the label swapping, they are going on the same path. That's about it. Okay, and they get out, and out they go out of the network. Okay, so the signal traffic engineering approach is appealing because you can choose a route independently and set it up even before traffic shows up, right? I can set up a whole bunch of routes in advance of traffic. Okay, and then the primary purpose of signaling this case is to map global IDs in this, like addresses and path specifications, to local IDs called labels. Okay, in addition you might reserve resources, but that's up to you. Okay, but the overall downside of a signaled approach are that, I mean, every router in this network should support signaling, right? It requires extensive upgrades in the network, and once you form an area boundary like an internal gateway routing boundary, you cannot signal outside the boundary. Okay, so even though ATM allows you to signal across peer groups, now in the internet, in reality, I mean, different networks operate with different protocols. You cannot run MPLS signaling on top of an OSPF network unless it's upgraded, right? So, and so even this is even within a single autonomous system. Now it's almost impossible to go beyond autonomous systems. Okay, there have been some weak proposals that have been floated for both these cases, but they have not gone anywhere. Okay, so essentially one of the big problems in traffic engineering is that it is still restricted to within a single area. Okay, and one of the works at RPI which we have done is to be able to extend the concept of traffic engineering to a connectionless paradigm. That is, you don't actually need signaling, and by that you can actually cross multiple areas, you can go across multiple domains, and in fact you can even talk about traffic engineering at a high level, like at the application level, routing level, or even at the peer-to-peer routing level. Okay, so we'll look at that later. Okay, just to give you an idea. So hop-by-hop routing is increasingly becoming similar to explicit routing in terms of capabilities, but superficially it looks very different. Okay, so at least the way the hop-by-hop routing exists on the internet, you have distributed routing. In other words, you have each hop collects information or condensed global state, like the network map, or it contains distance vector information, and then it distills that into forwarding tables by running a routing algorithm, whether it's a Dijkstra's algorithm or something else. Okay, and essentially it is difficult to perform traffic engineering because usually these fellows are limited to a single path. Okay, though there are routing protocols to compute multipaths, etc., and it's harder to do quality of service based routing. Okay, and you cannot do other like nice things, like if one path fails, what do you do? I mean, you'd like to reroute. Okay, so when you want to reroute, not only do you reroute just that path, but all other paths also get affected because of your reroute decision. Okay, so a lot of local change can actually trigger a set of global changes, whereas in explicit routing, you can actually control. Suppose some path goes down, you can actually remap only the traffic on that path to somebody else and not affect anybody else. Okay. So you can control the failure tolerance aspects and survivability aspects. Okay, we'll study this greater in traffic engineering, but that is one of the advantages of an explicit routing approach. Okay, which can be implemented using signaling. So I always use these words discreetly because explicit routing is a paradigm that can be either implemented in a connectionless or connection-oriented setup, whereas signaling is a connection-oriented way or a signal or a virtual circuit way of actually implementing explicit routing. Okay, now what has happened in the past, as I have described, is that signaling has become lightweight, more and more lightweight. Okay, when we studied XTAR 25, we saw a very heavyweight protocol. Frame relay made it very much more lightweight. ATM took it on and maintained the lightweight nature of the data plane, but then it made the control plane very heavyweight. Okay, now we shall study a little bit in RSVP now and in the later chapters that RSVP was a way of getting signaling into the internet. But then it was designed also for unicast and multicast, so it was sort of a heavyweight signaling protocol. But then MPLS found the right balance in terms of making signaling also lightweight and forwarding plane also lightweight, but it imposed a restriction such that all this lightweight capabilities could be achieved only within a single domain. Okay, now MPLS at its base is very lightweight. It is possible for particular implementation to be very heavyweight, okay, as you add more and more features to it. Okay, so explicit routing as a concept shows tremendous promise for traffic engineering, and it's I think one of the things of the future to watch out. Okay, so in this process, what I've described to you is how label switching works in the data plane. What is the basic idea of traffic engineering as a broad concept, and how it can be supported by explicit routing, which is implemented using a signal paradigm. Okay, now to actually do the signaling, you have to have a signaling protocol. So it turns out that there are a couple of signaling protocols that have been proposed in the context of MPLS. Now, one of them is called RSVP. It stands for Resource Reservation Protocol. Okay, it's a weird acronym. It grew out of the efforts of the internet folks to try to develop quality of service on the internet. Okay, so it was actually developed originally as a quality of service signaling protocol for the internet. Okay, now if you recall in ATM, the signaling protocol is actually guided by routing. Okay, and when the signaling call comes up, it will talk to the routing protocol like a PNNI and ask where should I go next. Okay, now so those two things are very tightly coupled in ATM. In RSVP, one of the key ideas is that the signaling protocol is decoupled. So this decoupling is a general theme in internet protocol design. So something that's very complex, you break it up into pieces. That's called decoupling. Okay, now RSVP was decoupled from routing. What that means was that you cannot change existing internet routing. I mean, internet routing is there, paths are already there, but then you can upgrade certain routers to support resource reservation by using existing paths. So they wanted to remain within the constraints of shortest path, etc., but at particular routers they wanted to be able to make a resource reservation. Okay, so that was how RSVP was proposed. And it was also proposed to be backward compatible with multicast, IP multicast model. Okay, we'll ignore that part right now. But essentially, RSVP is a lightweight signaling protocol that is designed, if you look at the name, it says resource reservation. It doesn't even say signaling in its name. Okay, so it was designed primarily for resource reservation by using whatever routing facilities are available. Okay, now, essentially what they did was they observed that RSVP was not going anywhere in terms of internet quality of service because nobody is deploying that. But they saw an opportunity in MPLS because Cisco had already implemented RSVP in all their routers, and Microsoft had implemented it in the latest versions of Windows, etc. So they said, why not we take the basic RSVP and just extend it to do MPLS signaling? Okay. So what is MPLS signaling? You just need to go and take a path specification of MPLS, okay, and then map it to local labels. Okay. So that's what happened. So so what happened is that basic idea of signaling, you just go set up at every hop and get acknowledgements, right? So okay, this is what I talked about. RSVP is internet signaling. It is the key idea is it's decoupled from routing. It also supports IP multicast. If you don't know anything about RSVP, this is all you need to know. Okay, so it has some nice features. Okay, to make it suited to the internet multicast model, it is not source initiated. If you see, ATM signaling the source, like when you pick up a phone call, the source telephone will initiate that signaling call. Whereas if you look at how you watch TV, right? I mean, you are the receiver of that TV signal or a television signal, and you turn on the TV, right? So when you turn on the TV, you basically join the airwaves, right? So like when you do internet multicast, or maybe there's a movie which is being played on the internet, or maybe like now World Cup cricket is going, and I'm a cricket fan. So when I tune on to World Cup cricket on the internet, so the receiver is the one who joins, okay? And the receiver initiates a signaling call that goes in the reverse direction and joins whatever streams are out there. Okay, so it's a receiver-initiated signaling paradigm that fits well within the IP multicast model. Okay, we are not going to debate that, but essentially what RSVP needed to do was to be extended to be source-initiated. Okay, RSVP was originally defined to be receiver-initiated. Now we are saying that it can also be source-initiated because that's how MPLS works. Okay, and it has a feature called soft state, which I shall describe much more detail when we talk about quality of service. But essentially soft state means that the state doesn't hang out there forever. Okay, if you make a circuit in say ATM, it'll just stay there till the signaling protocol actually tears it down. Whereas a soft state is like the hotel reservation or something like that. When you show up at a hotel, your records are there, but once you check out of the hotel, right, it just goes away. Okay, and even if you don't check out, the hotel will throw away those records. Okay, so soft state is a state which times out. Okay, so in that sense, it is soft. It's not hard. It doesn't stay there. Okay, it has some nice features, but we should ignore all this stuff. Okay, the way MPLS works is that normally it will send a beacon message known as a path message going from the source to the destination saying this is the path which is available. And then the destination sends a reserve message which comes in the reverse direction, which follows the trail left by the path messages and then sets up reservations. Okay, that is the basic idea of RSVP. Now, okay, well, I do have a diagram here. So path messages go from here and reach the destination, essentially lighting up the path. And then the destination shows up and say, okay, I want to reserve resources or I want to reserve this path. So here I could do the reservation of labels, okay, rather than actual resources. Okay, and as part of every hops reservation decision, it will do something called call admission control, which we studied earlier, right? So the call admission control says that, okay, I want so much resources. You can calculate what resource I want by looking at my RSpec, which says this is my this is what I want to reserve, and this is my traffic characteristics. Okay, okay. So we'll study all this stuff a little more detail, but essentially the signaling call comes back and says, okay, this is my traffic called traffic spec or T-spec, and this is the guarantee I want called RSpec. Can you provide that to me? If you can, admit my call and set up resources for me. Okay, this is classic. This is called call admission control module. And then if this is satisfied, essentially the call will proceed. Okay, so the summary of basic RSVP, I mean unmodified RSVP, is that there is this sort of beaconing path message which goes in the forward direction and the reserve message which goes in the reverse direction, and the state or reservations which are reserved can time out. Okay, in that sense they are soft state. Okay, the reason they can time out is because internet paths can change over time, right? So that was why it was designed to be soft state. If the internet paths change, you might need to re-establish reservations. So this path reserve is an ongoing process, unlike in the ATM world. I mean, once you set up these circuit, I mean, there's no need to run another signaling protocol to refresh that circuit, right? Anyways, so the key things that were done in the context of MPLS were the following. Okay, people recognize that the soft state thing was going nowhere. Okay, so soft state thing is nice in theory. Okay, but in a real network, I mean, once you make a reservation, you expect it to stay. There's no point like sending refresh messages. So they provide an option such that the soft state could be made hard state. Okay, one simple way is make the time infinite. Okay, so you time out after time infinity. Okay, something like that. Okay, then instead of having this path message providing a beacon and then doing reverse reservations, you can do forward reservations also. Okay, and that is provided, and it provides an explicit route object where the source can actually specify the full route, and RSVP just faithfully follows that route and goes and sets up the path. Okay, so then there's a bunch of other things here. We'll talk about that. So the explicit route object is the simple idea of specifying the full route, and then the RSVP just path messages go and set up that LSP for you. So in the context of MPLS, okay. Now this route could be either a loose route or a strict route. Okay, these are the same sense as how IP uses it. A loose source route is that where you provide only a partial route. Okay, Whereas a strict source route is one where you provide the full route. That means every router on the path should be provided. Okay. Now, so for a simple example, a strict source route, in this case, I would specify A, B, C, E, D, F. Okay. Whereas in a loose source route, I might just specify D, saying that I want to go through D. That's all. And then the A will try to find a path that reaches D. Okay. And it is free to choose whatever path. Okay. Now you could have a combination of strict and loose things. So some paths where you can specify every hop, and then other paths you can keep it loose. Okay. Now this, in the same sense, is how IP does it. So nothing fancy there. And then there are a bunch of label objects where you can request for a label and get a label and so on. Right. So this is if you remember the basic MPLS functionality, I will give you an IP address and I'll say give me a label. Okay. So if labels are assigned from the destination onwards back in a reverse direction. So there, in that paradigm, you do a label request and get back a label. Okay. Now this is the what I called a vanilla LSP when I described it in the last class. Okay. So and in record route option, this is pretty much like like a monitoring thing. I mean, once you have set up the route, you will just want to record. Suppose you are providing a path message without controlling what path it is. You'd like to figure out what is the actual route. Okay, and then a session attribute is an example of how you can control attributes of that session, like what its priority are, what its preemption are, and what are its other attributes like fast reroute, etc. Okay, so these are ways in which you can provide attributes to a particular path. So you can set up an LSP with some attributes, and then you can form traffic with some attributes and then map the two. Okay, so there's a classic support for traffic engineering. Okay, and then remember that if you throw away a basic routing protocol, you can also provide routing functions, like the elementary routing functions like hello messages or a state collection type messages. So remember, if you remember what OSPF does, OSPF sends hellos to all its neighbors, and then it also sends around LSPs to everybody so that they can form a map. Okay, now it is possible for you to do an interesting combination where you use OSPF just for the purposes of distributing LSPs. LSAs, link state advertisements. And with the link state advertisements, any node can form a full map of the network. Okay, once the full map has been formed, you don't talk up to OSPF again. OSPF also has another module which runs Dijkstra algorithm to compute the shortest path. So you can kill Dijkstra's algorithm and run your own favorite algorithm. Okay, or you can even not even run an algorithm. You can have a human operator who sees this map and say, I want this path. Okay, in an arbitrary, explicit manner. Okay. So OSPF in some sense can be used only for the purposes of collecting the state information. Okay. Now OSPF is also used for hello. Okay. So it is possible in an RSPF extension can provide that hello facility. So what will happen is each router can tell its neighbor router, hello, how are you? Okay. I'm alive and this is my attributes, etc. Okay. And you can also do path maintenance called refresh. This was nothing new, but essentially you can have this refresh thing not done at all, like infinity. Okay. And there are some aggregation ideas. So you don't want to see whenever we design a control protocol, immediately does the control protocol itself generate a lot of traffic is one of the worries. So you can aggregate messages, etc. Okay. So moving on. What can you do with these facilities? So we have a signaling protocol called RSVP. There's also another signaling protocol called LDP, which was designed in the context of MPLS, but I'll not go into that. Essentially, both of these can form link state paths, or they can set up link state paths. Label switched paths. Okay, both of these are LS. Okay. So label switched paths can be set up by these signaling protocols. Now there are two varieties of label switch paths. Okay, one variety could be called the vanilla label switch path. Okay, so confusingly enough, it's called signal label switch path. Okay, so here in this vanilla LSP, right, essentially you use the normal IP routing protocols, like you would use OSPF to not only collect the state of the network but also figure out what the shortest path is. Okay, but then you will explicitly signal the shortest path even though you don't have to. Okay, so this is what is known as a vanilla LSP. And so it is possible for you to specify a user configured explicit route object. A constrained LSP, essentially what you do is you don't use the Dijkstra algorithm. You can use what is known as a CSPF. C stands for constrained shortest path first algorithm. Okay, shortest path first, SPF stands for Dijkstra's algorithm. CSPF means that you can essentially run a quality of service based routing computation. So essentially you can say that, okay, I want a path, okay, which is shortest not in the sense of link weights, but it might be shortest in sense of other attributes. Maybe I want some minimum bandwidth, maybe I want some delay and so on. Okay, so there's an entire literature on quality of service routing where people have studied how to come up with alternate algorithms for meeting several characteristics. So it is possible for you to make reservations which have minimum bandwidth, etc. Okay, some of these problems turned out to be NP hard. Okay, in other words, they are very hard to compute, but there are heuristics for them and so on. But some of them are well within normal computing bounds. So so in an ISP, in the network operations center, these CSPF type algorithms will run, and the edges will be informed that you should be using these routes. And then when routes need to be established, you could use RSVP or one of these signaling protocols to actually go and set up the routes which have been pre-computed. Okay, so this way the service provider has a lot of control over what routes are set up and why. Okay, so CSPF, I already talked about this, essentially shortest path based on additional quality of service constraints. Okay, I'm not going to go into all great detail about how these things actually work, but you can imagine what it is, right? You can imagine that you have administrative constraints like bandwidth, or you might want to have delay constraints, etc. Okay, so after you computed this, the CSPF will hand out the full explicit route object, or which means it's the actual full route, to RSVP, and RSVP will just faithfully go and set up the labels. And once the labels are set up and once the forwarding equivalence class has been defined, the edge router essentially maps the forwarding equivalence class to the appropriate route. Okay, that's about it. Okay, so the summary, the key benefits of MPLS is to allow low overhead virtual circuits for IP. Now this, why would anybody care about virtual circuits for IP for the purpose of traffic engineering? Okay, now it is possible when MPLS was first being designed, it was thought of as a solution to the IP over ATM problem, because ATM was the only network that could offer that kinds of speeds and that kinds of quality of service. Okay, but the speed argument has gone away, because it is possible, as I shall talk about in the next lecture, to build very, very high speed routers. I mean, we are talking about terabits per second type of routers, which are possible today. Okay, and you can just take IP operated on top of PPP and map it on top of SONET, so called packet over SONET type routers. Okay, and we shall give examples of that in the next class. So these are all available already. Okay, so at that time, however, it was not available. Some of the key problems were not solved. So MPLS was originally thought of as a way to provide all these high speed features and these quality of service features. Now essentially, this, since the high speed argument went away, rationale went away, so the quality of service became sort of fudged, and the whole thing is being called traffic engineering now. So traffic engineering is sort of a generic view of quality of service, or in a higher granularity view of quality of service, where quality of service is a much more broader area where you not only talk about routing and mapping traffic to specific paths, you're also talking about, okay, how do you actually do quality of service within a single path? Okay, once you've chosen a path, how do you do admission control? How do you do the actual building blocks like shapers, schedulers, etc.? Okay, so traffic engineering remains to be the key benefit of MPLS. Still, you have to upgrade your network to do that. It is possible to sort of minimize the pain in some sense, that you can take existing ATM switches and upgrade them to do MPLS. It is possible to upgrade existing router cores with the software upgrades to do MPLS and so on. So it's a well-marketed technology, and it's purportedly the idea, the benefits are in traffic engineering, which presumably will allow ISPs to offer multiple new services like voice over IP, VPNs, etc. And because of the telecom implosion, some of the stuff has slowed down. Okay, so but the benefits remain. Okay, and it also allows ISPs to optimize the networks much better. And we shall talk about some of these aspects later. And another key idea, the whole reason why we are studying it in optical networks, is that this can be generalized. MPLS as a concept can be generalized as a generic control plane methodology for even controlling all optical networks or hybrid optical electronic networks. Okay, so that generalization is called GMPLS, or generalized MPLS. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, so without further ado, let's go on to the next topic. And as you shall see here, we have 170 slides here. Okay, so it's a big slide set. So it'll take a couple of, at least two, three classes to get through this. So in this slide set, we will cover all the basic ideas in developing high-speed routers and some of the new trends. Okay, whether the new trends area, I'll talk about two major trends. One trend is called about network processes, how network processes are happening, which are revolutionizing the way edge routers are being developed primarily, and then how terabit routers or very, very high speed routers are being developed. What are the constraints? Okay, and it's all very logical. Okay, the ideas are very, very straightforward. Okay, but it's just that they put together, the area becomes very complex. Okay, and certainly this has been an area where lots of fine people have worked. There have been great advances in the commercial world. Okay, so I have lots of acknowledgements. I've taken slides from several of my colleagues in Intel who support our work through network process, as well as IBM Zurich, Nick McKeon at Stanford, and Keshav's book. Okay, and by the way, Douglas Comer, just can we focus this here, please? I just got this new book, and it's a phenomenal book. I just want to introduce you guys to this. Can we focus here, please? Okay, so there's a new book called Network System Design with Using Network Process. Okay, it's just come out. Okay. Anyway, this is by Douglas Comer, the same guy who wrote TCP/IP book and also all that. And it's characteristic in his style. I mean, Douglas Comer is a wonderful writer. Okay, and he has his knack of making complex topics very, very simple to understand. Okay, so this is like a storybook. Okay, I breezed through it in a couple of hours. So it's so easy to read and brings ideas in a very accessible manner. Okay, so it describes this new wave of network process, etc. But I've recommended this as a reference. I've taken information from this for the slide set, but you don't need to buy it for this class. Okay, if you're interested in network process, you should certainly look at this book. Okay, so move on. So we are going to look up. You're going to study network process in both in a historical context, how they have evolved. And there are three major aspects of network process. Okay, one is a lookup algorithm. It's a very simple thing. Okay, I have a packet, it shows up. It comes on an input port. I have to figure out which output port to go. Okay, this is a standard. So I have to look up a table and forward it. Right? It sounds so simple. Okay, why the heck has it to be so complex? Why do you have to spend 100 slides to describe it? Right? So it's a important question. So think about it. So we'll talk about lookup algorithm. How can lookup algorithm? So the answer, sneak peek answer, is that you want to do it at terabit speeds, okay? And you want to do it in a very small form factor with power constraints, okay? So that is a simple thing. Usually the basic answer is very simple. If you want to make it very low speed, you can do it in a software, okay? It is possible. Today software routers exist, and I teach another class called experimental networking, and as part of that class, we actually do software routers called click routers and so on, and these are like fantastic things to play around with, okay? But once you want to make it go in higher and higher speeds, you need to go into hardware and starts becoming messy. Okay, another part of the puzzle is called switching, how do we build data paths, high-speed data paths, to basically shuttle a packet once you've chosen the output port to go from input to output. Okay, this is another like drop-dead simple thing. It's like brain-dead thing, right? So I have to go from input to output. How complex can it get? Okay, again, we spent 50 slides on this. Okay, so, and then the other part is what is known as classification. Essentially what it means is that when a packet comes, it might belong to a flow, right? Or it might belong to a traffic aggregate, as I mentioned, right? So, and I need to sort of classify it so that I give it the appropriate service, okay? Like I might want to put it in a special queue, or I might want to give it some buffers, or give some buffer management priority, or give some priority in terms of how I transmit it through the switch. So, but for this, I just need to make a decision on a packet to figure out what class this fellow belongs to. Okay, this turns out to be a very incredibly hard problem, okay, especially at high speeds. Okay, now, so let's look at why. Okay, so what do switches and routers look like? Okay, so I basically grabbed some photos of the web. Okay, so this is how they look like. So you can have like high speed routers which look like these huge castles over here. Okay, or old ATM, well, it's still there. ATM switches look like this. And access routers, there's these tiny boxes here. So why do these things look like they are? Okay, now if I look at the dimensions, right, so some of the top of the line routers like Cisco's 1200 series router, which supports OC192 interfaces, provides internal switching capacity of 160 gigabit per second. Okay, remember that this means I can put 10 gigabit per second ports, okay, and still switch at full capacity. Okay, so 10 gigabit per second is OC192. Okay, and then so if you count these fellows, you'll count 16 of them. Okay, so then here Juniper's M160 gives you 8 of these fellows, OC192 ports. Okay, so you add 8 times 10, it's 80 gigabit per second. Okay, So, but the interesting numbers are the others which are listed here. What are the dimensions? Okay, how wide they are, how tall they are, and so on and so forth. Okay, so and how much power they consume. Okay, so where are these guys? Where are these routers? Okay, so obviously they are in the internet core somewhere hiding from us. Okay, so there are carrier class switches or carrier class routers, or ATM switches, and even some frame relay switches are there in the internet core, and IP traffic is traveling over all these fellows. And at the edge of these networks, you have edge routers, and these guys are also becoming incredibly fast, but edge routers also have to support more services. They need to be able to define traffic aggregates and then map them to paths. They need to do fancy stuff like quality of service. We'll study more about that, but essentially edge routers have all these other, they need to treat flows at finer granularities, lots of flows. They need to have a variety of interfaces coming from customers who might have T1 lines, they might have OC3 lines, they might have frame relay lines. There will be a heterogeneous set of interfaces and heterogeneous services, whereas these fellows here in the middle of the network, I mean, are just speed. I mean, get the damn thing across. Okay, that's all they want to do. Okay. Okay, and then even into the wide area network or within the enterprise, you have enterprise edge nodes and so on, and all the way to your rack. Okay, if you come to my networks lab, I'll invite you to come. I mean, we have sort of racks of switches and things like that. Which we, I mean, these are like extremely cheap thing. If you go to Dell and you can order switches for like, which actually can switch 16 or 24 gigabit Ethernet, okay, which means it's 16 times gigabit per second, right? 16 gigabit per second switching capacity today is available for like $1,500. Okay, and if you want to buy like trivial switches, like today, I just recently bought a home router. Okay, so it's like you can get wireless connectivity and it has a router and a 5-port switch. Okay, all of these can operate at 100 megabit per second. So this fellow itself has 1 gigabit per second switching. Okay, and I bought it for $100. Okay, so I mean, and by the way, the same $100 thing which I have now, a few years back, it would have cost me a fortune, okay, to buy it. Anyway, so that's how technology continues to gallop. And where are these routers? Okay, routers are at points of presence. Okay, now points of presence are, remember that POP came up in the context of where local exchange carriers and telephony interconnect with wide area networks, right? So similarly, the same word has been co-opted for internet as well. Okay, so that is where ISPs meet with each other or ISPs maintain their operations. Okay, so POP is a slightly different context. Okay, now routers are at these fellows. Okay, now at each of these POPs, if you magnify it, you'll see a lot of routers. Okay, now if you go to a major operation like UUNET, okay, now each POP will have like 10,000 or 100,000 routers. I mean, 10,000 routers or something. I mean, we're like thousands of routers just hanging out there. Okay, now people are trying to consolidate it. Okay, why do you need big routers? Why do you need big, fast routers? Okay, there's a real reason. If I have a POP with smaller routers, which means smaller capacity and so on, you'll have to have lots of connection between them so that you have a better network and you connect to the external world. In a bigger router, you'll have only fewer interconnections between them, okay, and then you'll have a larger aggregate switching capacity within these routers. So why is this important? Okay, this is important because of two reasons. One, POPs are constrained for space. Okay, now you don't have to really go to a real POP to figure this out. Okay, you just have to come to the networks lab. Okay, now networks lab in the last year has grown from like zero to like overflowing. We have equipment, but we don't know where to keep it. Okay, so this is a standard space problem. Okay, so you do all the usual things like put things on racks and so on. So you'll be demanding things which are rack mountable, and each thing should be small, and they should not consume tons of power and so on. So they should consume standard power from the racks and so on. So primarily space and power are two major constraints in POP architecture. Okay, so I want to be able to do more with the same space, same power. So more means what? I have to have more capacity, right? So the other aspect of it is that line cards are where router vendors make money. Okay, actually router vendors give away their basic switch fabric and so on, or their entire chassis. Okay, and then you can buy line cards from them. Okay, and these line cards cost a fortune. Okay, so that's where they make the money off. So, I mean, one way where financial analysts value router companies to see how much line cards they sell. Okay, so line cards are incredibly costly. Now, by the way, line cards, I don't know, I should show this diagram earlier. Oh, here. Now, you see this diagram here where this line card is so big, it's about a couple of feet here. Okay, the same line card OC192 is now available like this today. Okay, so every 3 years line cards also shrink every couple of years. Okay, and I have a colleague here who used to work on such routers. So he actually brought one line card for my experimental networking class last year and showed us. So it was quite incredible to see something just so big shrinking into something so small. Okay, but that's the truth. Okay, so let's move on. Okay, so essentially line cards are shrinking, space is shrinking, power is a constant, and so on and so forth. And within that, you want to do more and more. Okay, so you want to have more denser interfaces or have more interfaces and consume the same power. And you're playing the economics game in terms of interfaces also. Okay, so there's a clear industry trends towards consolidating these routers and so on. So the router's architect is very straightforward. Okay, you want to maximize the capacity of a box C. Okay, now I'll tell you what I mean by this magic number C. Subject to constraints on power, 5 kilowatts is as much as you can consume per box, and volume. You cannot make this thing occupy the entire room. Okay, so there is also more constraints on volume. It must fit racks, standard sizes, etc. Okay, now so some of the performance metrics, which are a little more detailed, are that I talked about maximizing aggregate capacity, right? You can also, ISP is also interested in maximizing usage of whatever their costly links are. Suppose something is costly, you'd like to maximize usage. So they'd like to offer services on them, like quality of service, etc. So typically they'd like to do fancy weighted fare queuing and other quality of service building blocks on these. Okay. Now, a theory has shown, and we'll study this theory in the quality of service section, that if I have output queued routers, you can do it, okay? But that's theory, okay? In practice, it's very, very hard to build output queued routers, okay? Especially for the speeds we're talking about. The other aspect, which is also related to throughput, it's a quality of service constraint. I need to be able to tweak or control delay offered to particular flows. Again, this can be feasible with output queuing based thing, and then I can offer some weighted fare queuing which can be tweaked to offer delay. Okay, but the problem is that output queued switches are impractical. Okay, the reason they're impractical is that essentially what output queued means is that I put a buffer or a queue at the output, right? That's what I do. And then I have a switch which has lots of inputs which can feed to this output. Okay, so what this means is that buffer is essentially memory, right? Should be able to work at the speed of all these inputs combined. Okay, I should be able to receive packets from all these inputs, even though the output is still at a single rate. So I have to add up all the inputs and find the speed and find memory which can run at that speed. Okay, the reason that's a problem is that memory doesn't follow Moore's law. Okay, the memory capacity follows Moore's law, but memory access bandwidth does not follow Moore's law. So it's very hard to build memory that is a high speed access. Okay, so that is the primary reason why you can't build output queue switches. Okay, so people have tried other fancy things, like instead of having one output queue, why not have many output queues and so on. But then even the switch, computational switch to move from one, access these output queues becomes extremely complex. Okay, so the big picture looks like this. Line capacity demands keep growing very fast. Okay, so it almost within a year, they expect you to double your line capacity and so on, at least more in the recent past. And router capacity as a total, which includes both line capacity and switching capacity, is also increasing at a rate faster than Moore's law or the demands of router capacity. Remember that Moore's, so this means that this gap between Moore's law has to be and the demand should be satisfied by clever design. Okay, this you can think of as basically like a design gap. Okay, and it's continuing to grow. Okay. So, of course, the demands have sort of flattened out a little more because of the telecom depression and so on. But then once the last mile problem is solved and you have lots more bandwidth coming from the last mile through new applications, it will start recharging again. And the other fundamental problem is not only this, you have this gap with respect to Moore's law in terms of memory capacity and in terms of computation speeds, you have a huge gap with respect to DRAM access speeds. Okay, these fellows don't improve as rapidly as we'd like them to. Okay, and moreover, as I mentioned, the gap in terms of Moore's law itself means that I have to try to minimize the number of instructions I have to process on a per packet basis. So because these instructions I need to do to get a packet, to figure out where a packet needs to go, right? It's a lookup algorithm, the switching algorithm, etc. All need some packet processing. So there's been a general trend that the only way you can build higher and higher speed routers is to minimize the CPU instructions. Okay, so in fact, this curve itself represents an incredible improvement. Okay, with 10 instructions or less than 10 instructions per packet in 2001, you can get a packet out of the door. Okay, now this is, I'm talking about machine level 10 instructions. Okay, so this is quite an incredible feat. Okay, so given this high level context, what are the basic ideas? Okay, what are we trying to do? Okay, if you're trying to build an ATM switch, I'd like to look up a cell like a VCI, VPI in a virtual circuit table, okay? And then I need to do a swap operation. This is called label swapping, right? Remember? So I need to packet process. I need to rewrite the packet header and then forward the cell to an outgoing interface. Okay, forward means in this case, I need to shuttle the packet from input to output and then I need to send it, kick it out of the door, out of my router, right? That means transmit the cell onto the link. Now there are switches called layer 2 switches which operate for Ethernet. Okay, now these fellows essentially they do a layer 2 switching operation. Okay, and what is that? They take the frame shows up like an Ethernet frame. Okay, at this bridge basically, and then I look at the destination address into a forwarding table called a label bridge forwarding table, and then if I see it in my forwarding table, if there's an exact match, I forward to the correct port. If there's no exact match, I'll broadcast it to all ports. Okay, this is why bridges are ineffective, right? I mean, they don't scale very much. And then on the side, I need to learn the source address by snooping on incoming frames, right? And then I need to do the usual forward and transmit. An IP router will need to take a packet destination address. DA here stands for destination address. And then if I know the destination, I will forward it to the correct port, okay? And unknown, either I send it to default or I drop the packet. Okay, these are the usual thing. And then in addition to that, I need to do decrement of the TTL field and update checksum, etc. Okay. These all add to instructions which I need to do. And then I need to do the forward and transmit. It turns out that this step, right, to look up the packet is a more complex operation. It's not just an exact match. It's the longest prefix match in IP, okay, if you recall that. Okay, now that starts, even that small qualification of longest prefix makes it a big horror story in terms of forwarding. Okay, so we'll have to figure that out. So to do this, how do routers look like today? They have basic architectural components. Okay, there's a control plane. Okay, this is why I call this a control plane, because it's separated or decoupled from the actual data path or data plane. And the control plane, you do things which are called routing. Okay, and sometimes you might do things called congestion control. Okay, but this is a dubious thing. Anyway, so you do admission control, you do reservations and all these other fancy things, signaling, all of them show up with this control plane functions. Data plane is what is simply understood as per packet processing. For every packet you have to do this, whereas for control you don't do this in every packet. Okay, obviously you try to do it for larger aggregates of packets, either which are circuits or in IP, control plane operates completely independent of data plane. I mean, it'll just set up its path. It's not on a per aggregate basis. Okay, it just sets up the path when links come up and come down, etc. So that is control plane. And data plane, you have to, you might have quality of service functions like policing, scheduling, and then you have a basic lookup problem at the input, and you have to switch the fellow out through the switching infrastructure, and then go to the output, and the output you might have other scheduling, and then send the packet out. So today routers look like this. Essentially, they will have line cards which have onboard embedded processors or ASIC. Implementations where forwarding table or a piece of forwarding table is cached, and this forwarding table is used to make a forwarding decision or a lookup decision at the input interface itself. And then you might have an input queued switch where most of the queuing occurs here, waiting for availability of the interconnect. The interconnect, a simple way to think about an interconnect is a bus. Okay, now a single bus might be contention for the interconnect. I mean, the bus might not be available. Okay, more smarter interconnect is like a crossbar, where bandwidth is always available in the interconnect. Okay, now so switches are usually in the middle. Okay, there's some possibility that you might not find a path through, so you have to hang out here in the buffer, input buffer. So once you get through the network, okay, so there is a interconnect design problem. or this is known as a switch fabric design problem. This is because if you look at this grid, right, it looks like a fabric, cloth fabric. That's why it's called switch fabric. And then at the output port, you can also have additional output scheduling capabilities. So the input side, you basically do some header processing on data. So the key thing to notice is that what you really care about in switches, at least packet switches, are how many packets you shuttle through. You can have, say, suppose you have lots of data and just a tiny header, right? You'll be quite efficient in terms of your packet shuttling capabilities, because all you need to do is process the header. But if I have a large header related to data, which means that most packets are small, then I have to really work hard, because the header processing time is still a constant, right? I have to do these operations. So it depends upon the average size of data, etc. Okay, and in the internet, it's a mixed blessing. We have lots of packets which are very small. These are 40 byte or 64 byte packets, which occur because of telnet or primarily because of TCP acknowledgements, right? Come back in the reverse direction, and these are just 40 byte packets, and you add an Ethernet header, they're very small packets. So you have lots of 40 byte packets showing up. Almost 30% of all internet traffic is 40 byte packets. Okay, and then the other 30%, there are a lot of Ethernet sized packets, and then there are some 576 sized packets. So the Ethernet, the traffic statistics are sort of multimodal, okay, pretty much bimodal. You have a big hump in terms of Ethernet type packets, and then you have another mode or another peak of probability distribution in terms of small 40 byte packets. Okay, now you need to be able to process all these guys. Okay, as far as header processing goes, you don't care about the data. Usually what happens is you take the data and dump it into DRAM, you take the header. Okay, this DRAM is called a shared DRAM. Okay, and there might be a common shared memory across the switch fabric. So take the data and basically chuck it into DRAM, and you just take the header, figure out where it wants to go, and then you might queue a packet, and all this might be done in SRAM, which might be on-chip or off-chip. And then once the switch fabric is available, which is essentially a data path through the switch, figuratively this header or packet through the network, and when it shows up the receiver, you get back your data from the DRAM, and you have an entire packet, and then throw it out into the network. Okay, so as I said, here what you have is you have an address table, or you can essentially, this can also be thought of as a forwarding table or a cache. So you need to be able to do a lookup algorithm here to ask for the IP address and so on. So you can cache up to quite a lot of 1 million prefixes over here in terms of the address. And usually this is done on DRAM, and you can also have buffer memory, and typically data, most of the data sits on DRAM. Okay. Now this happens for every input port. Okay, every input port has its own sophisticated stuff. And then it goes through the switch fabric, reaches the output, and then you have a buffer manager, etc., and then it goes out in the link. Okay, so this is the basic broad 20,000 foot view, right? So let's start from the simplest stuff. Okay, why can't I just build high speed routers from software? Okay, let me take off the shelf PCs. Okay, run Linux. Okay, what does a router do? It forwards packets, right? If I just take two interfaces, take my computer, it has PCI cards, right? Just throw multiple network interfaces, okay, and then connect Ethernets to them or gigabit Ethernets to them and so on, and then make this fellow work as a router, right? Why not? And make all the routing function in software. So when a packet shows up at the operating system level, you need to be able to maintain a table there, and then take the packet, throw it out in the output interface, just like IP would do. And indeed, this has been done, okay? And it's been done it's been done with flying colors in some sense. You can do software routers which are incredibly fast. Okay, they almost reach the limits of what a PC can do. And one beautiful example of this is MIT's Click Router. Okay, now Click Router not only does a router interface, it's a modular router. It allows you to program in C++ inside the kernel. Okay, so now this is quite an incredible feat. Remember that kernel means spaghetti code. Okay, so kernel is usually programmed in C and so on. Okay, but there are a bunch of routers which are coming out right now, like MIT's Click Router. There's another couple of efforts going around in different universities and other places where they're building much more production class software routers. Okay, and we are in fact using a lot of this. So the primary advantage of the software router is that it's modular, which means you can extend it very easily. Okay, in fact, when we come up with new routing algorithms or new fancy quality of service algorithms, what we do is we first test it in simulation, okay, and after we are convinced that it works, then we go to a software router and try to implement it on a software router. Once we are convinced that it works there, using some emulation test bed like Utah's Emulab, then we go to the real internet and actually deploy it in an overlay network. Okay, so this is something which we are doing for some of our research projects. So software routers are great to modify, extend, prototype, etc. Okay, but the only problem is that they're not very fast. Okay, and they're very cheap. You can just take a $500 box, and you can build a very sophisticated software router with that. But they are slow in aggregate terms, because the reason is they're slow in two terms. Okay, I cannot have lots of interfaces. Even if my PC were theoretically to have 10 interface cards, I could put 10 interface cards. My software router cannot switch at that speed. Why? Because even if I do the basic math, take the highest processing speed of the computer, like 2.4 gigahertz or something like that, right? And see how many packets can it shuttle, okay? And take care of all the basic things like interrupts and other things. So that if you do simple math, you'll figure out that the probably limits of the software routers are like a few 100,000 packets per second, okay? These are small size packets. Okay, now so what is a few 100,000 packets per second? How far can I go? Okay, here's a simple chart that gives. So 100,000 packets per second means that it's the aggregate switching capacity. Aggregate means that from all my interfaces, if packets are coming in all interfaces and I add it up, the total packets I can throw from one interface to the other is 100,000, right? So let's look at that number 100,000. So it comes somewhere here, right? So what it tells me is that if I have a router that say gives 400,000 packets per second, what it tells me is that I can, if these are all 64 byte packets, I can probably support 200 megabit Ethernet to it. So it's very good for a router that has exactly two interfaces, and the max capacity on those two interfaces is 100 megabits per second. Okay. Now that's not how the internet core is, right? The internet core has, as I showed you, those routers where they had 8 to 16 interfaces which operate at 10 gigabit per second each, right? So you're talking about aggregate switching capacity of several gigabit per second. Okay. So I'm sort of mixing the aggregate packet rates and bit rates, but I mean one can do the math essentially. So if I go to gigabit per second, which is OC192, right, just to switch the traffic from a single OC192, essentially I should be able to do 400 kilopackets per second, okay, or pretty much so many megapackets per second. Okay, so I need to be able to do so much just for one interface. So I need to multiply this by 8 or 16 to get what is the packet rate I need to support. And this brown line says that there's a slight difference if you do 64 packets or 1518 packets. Essentially, you'll have an order of magnitude difference, yes, but this is a logarithmic graph, right? So it's not great. Okay, so because the internet is a mix of these two things, I need to support this anyway, and I need to support this. So the demands on high-speed routers are primarily two issues. One is aggregate bit rate. I need to have aggregate packet rate to switch it, and just by taking an off-the-shelf PC or software, I cannot support aggregate bit rate, and by implication, I cannot support a lot of interfaces. So if I were to take today's PCs and give it like five interfaces, each running at 100 megabits per second, even the click router cannot support it because it just can't run that fast. Okay, so whereas if I had like fancy multiprocessors, probably it could. Okay, now I'm talking about a click router running on just the off-the-shelf Dell PC or something like that. Okay, now another way of looking at speeds is to look at the inverse of bitrate, which is packet processing time. So this is essentially when a packet shows up, you have a time budget. Okay, and within that time budget, you've got to do all you can with that packet. And essentially, what you need to do, you need to take the packet, look it up, switch it, that's it. Okay, that's all. But this itself, the time budget is shrinking. Okay, if you look at it, if I'm talking about small packets, right, which is usually the design target, if I take 10 base T, right, a 64 byte packet is 51.2 microseconds. Okay, now you might remember it from your Ethernet days, because 51.2 microseconds is also the maximum distance, the maximum propagation time possible on Ethernet. Okay, that's why the packet size is 64. Okay, now essentially as I go to 100 base T, this time shrinks, and let's talk about something which people are designing today, right, OC192 and so on. We're talking about like 50 nanoseconds. Okay, you have 50 nanoseconds to take a packet and switch it. Okay, now why is this a big deal? Okay, I didn't put why it's a big deal here. Okay, big deal is very because DRAM takes 50 nanoseconds just to make one access. Okay, you take 20 to 40 nanoseconds just to access DRAM once. Okay, forget operations. And so that is one of the primary reasons. So you can only do maybe two or three instructions and access DRAM once. Okay, that's all you can do. What can you do with that? So that is the primary question here. So how can, even under that tight time budget, how can I switch? Okay, so anything which becomes complex becomes impossible, right? So the rule of hardware is try to make it as simple as possible so that you can shrink it and make it small. Right? Anything that's big or complex will be slow. Okay, so that's the basic challenge. So essentially the way people have been trying to tackle it is, okay, first appeal to Moore's law. Okay, now Moore's law and the memory growth capacity itself, will it take care of the problem? Okay, and as I showed you the big picture graph, it doesn't necessarily take care of the problem because there's a gap. Okay, and that gap is a design gap. You have to fill it with design innovations. And so what people have done is people have tried to do all kinds of fancy stuff, and a lot of this has been learned from the processing community, that is computer system side of things, where if you take the modern Intel processors, they not only provide pipelining capabilities, they also provide fine-grained parallelism, okay, which means that multiple instructions can operate in parallel and each instruction can go within its own pipeline. Okay, and if you take multiprocessor systems, you can have many processors which operate in parallel and you can sort of shuttle information, you can give instructions to each of these processors. You can try to leverage the parallelism or concurrency inherent in your program itself, or you can explicitly program your software to take care of concurrency, okay, or leverage concurrency. Okay, now there are limits to how far this can be done. Okay, and if you take a parallel systems class, this is what you learn. Okay, they'll go into all kinds of techniques of basically extracting and leveraging all the parallelism you can from existing programs, either in an explicit manner, like you actually write code, parallel code, or in an implicit manner, that is, either you have a compiler that can optimize your existing sort of sequential code to make it run well on a parallel machine. Okay, so today if you take your normal programs like graphics or whatever, Word and so on, right, the Intel compilers essentially will operate either on the compiler level or on the executable level. I mean, you're not going to recompile your code and so on, right? You'll be able to take the existing executables and then make them run faster on multiprocessor systems, etc. Okay, so when you buy dual processor systems and so on, or servers and so on, they are optimized for that. Okay, that's the challenge in that. Now, and the other thing which computers have done is, when for graphics, people have learned from a long time that if you want to have very processing intensive function, you have a separate processor that does all the graphics processing. Okay, so or it could have a separate coprocessor that does things like floating point operations. So these are called coprocessors. So essentially, they have appeared under a new name for networking, and these are known as ASICs. Okay, now essentially what you do in coprocessors is you can have a programmable coprocessor. ASICs is the one which where you have essentially programmed it once. It's a hardware programmed thing. So you can take specific functions like lookup algorithm, right, and create an ASIC for that. Okay, or you can create a buffering algorithm, okay, or a switch itself or a data path that you can create ASICs for that. So these ASICs, some of them are general. They can support multiple functions. Like you can have an ASIC just to do firewalling functions, etc. Right? And now you can essentially create a chipset or a board which is made out of these ASICs, and or a data path that's combined with these coprocessors. Okay? And you can also leverage all these other forms of parallelism. Okay? Then what you do is you take earlier the first generation NICs. They're dumb. Okay? They used to say take a packet and they used to dump it into DMA. Okay? And then the processor has to take care of it. There's just a common shared bus and so on. Now what you do, NICs are becoming a lot more intelligent. And as I showed you the earlier diagram, NICs have almost all the lookup functionality and it has buffering capability. And the only thing the switch has to do is shuttle packets across. Okay, so NICs are becoming much more sophisticated and fairly smart. And now the questions are about where do I put memory? Okay, now how much memory can I put on chip, off chip? Should it be SRAM or DRAM, etc.? Those are the questions. And another sort of radical way to think about hardware is, my hardware is not moving fast enough. So why not I change my software to suit the hardware trends, okay? Now that's one way of actually thinking about ATM. Okay, ATM was developed as a protocol that was optimized for high-speed switching. Okay, so it observed that if I had fixed size cells, I can build high-speed switches, Right? I've mentioned this several times. So essentially, you designed a protocol, or in fact, the network layer and above, based upon hardware constraints. Okay, and what has happened, as it's always happened in history, is that hardware constraints have vanished over time. Okay, people, our technology innovations have always made hardware issues go away. Okay, so software remains the thing which is far more durable. So, so designing protocols to suit hardware speeds has not been the way of the of, even though that key idea keeps coming up again and again, it's not historically not been a successful approach. But that's one way of doing things. Okay, cell switching, because of its fixed size, small cell nature, you can build highly optimized cell switches. Okay, so basically these are some simple diagrams to show you that. So you can have some layer 2 processing and some most of layer 2 processing and some layer 3 processing at interfaces, and then you have either a standard CPU or basically data path to do all of the processing and get it out to the outgoing interfaces. And even within a process here, essentially you can have a sophisticated pipeline where you break it up and extract the parallelism as much as you can. Okay, the tragedy is that packet processing or the way protocols have been designed, you can't extract too much parallelism out of the way because layers are inherently sequential and so on and so forth. Okay, but designers have found incredible ways of extracting parallelization out of these things. Okay, so one way of extracting parallelism is to look hard at why you do multiplexing, demultiplexing, and how can you actually change its implementation. Okay, now remember what multiplexing and demultiplexing are. It's just a way of sharing a resource, right? So the way you do multiplexing, demultiplexing in a protocol is to specify a port number, okay, and then with that you can decide each layer can independently decide. Okay, but when you build a switch, packet switch, essentially you combine both of these layers and build a switch which can do both of them together. So instead of doing demultiplexing, what you do is you do a broader operation called packet classification. And essentially what you do is you take the entire packet and then look at multiple header fields at the packet to determine which flow this packet belongs to, okay, or which traffic aggregates this packet belongs to. And then essentially that defines a flow or a hash that defines a flow or a classification that defines a flow. And then you provide some kind of operation for that flow. Okay, maybe that operation is just a forwarding operation, maybe it's a quality of service operation. So packet classification can be thought of as a generalization of demultiplexing or multiplexing, where the overall goal is to classify or segregate flows. So one simple example of a classification is that there are Ethernet headers, there are IP headers, there are TCP headers, but I might want to look at the Ethernet type field, IP type field, and TCP destination port field together to and hash or concatenate these three things together, okay, as a single bit stream, and then look all of these up together. Okay, that's much faster than doing each of this in sequence. So here's an example of how you can break layering. I mean, and from the implementation viewpoint, but come up with a much harder, much faster implementation. Okay, so you can specify the appropriate header fields you want to classify upon in what is known as a rule set. Okay, this is a standard classification problem, and the overall objective is to be able to identify different flows and apply different operations. So one way to hardware optimization, I just talked about this. You have a large register, okay, and then you take the packet in memory. You just basically extract the appropriate fields, take one hardware register, and then do a direct comparison as though this whole thing was a single field and not made of multiple fields. And then this result of a comparison here just gives you whether it's a flow or it'll throw out as not a flow. So in general, the way classifiers are built is you have a hardware classifier. When packets show up, some of these packets are thrown out saying these belong to these flows. If these flows are not recognized here, then you have a more detailed software classifier. Okay, so basically we will use the concepts as follows. Okay, classification essentially maps packet to a flow. Okay, and forwarding maps a flow to a what we call a packet disposition. Okay, this is like a forwarding equivalence class. So it gives its quality of service and so on. Okay, or you can forwarding behavior is defined by this mapping. Okay, the reason I do like this, remember these are all bindings, mappings, indirection. I keep using these words again and again, right? These words are used to simplify the understanding of protocols because it's a nice way to think about it so that you can, at this point, you can decouple it and design this part separately and design this part separately. That is the basic idea. So in a connection-oriented network, right, This process is fairly simple because ATM or any other MPLS and all, right, has already assigned labels for the entire packet class, right? Forwarding equivalence class already has one single label. So this the classification part is extremely simple. Just take that label, directly match. Whereas in IP, these labels are not predefined in general, right? In a connectionless, so you have to sort of extract multiple labels out and then compare them, etc. So classification is much more harder in a connectionless network rather than a connection-oriented network. Okay, basically what you need is some kind of a flow ID field. Even in a connectionless network, somebody sets up a flow ID field for you, like it's been proposed in IPv6, then it's much more easy to do classification. Okay, so today the way the routers work is that you have functions of classification, forwarding, and data path. Okay, so most of it is in hardware. Okay, and of course there is some lot of these exceptions like IP options, or there are other things which are called slow path. That is usually handled by software. Okay, so and software is extremely slow compared to hardware. So and it's possible for you to have lots of reordering between fast path and slow path. So suppose you have some packages go on fast path, some packages go on slow path. The slow path fellows will turn up very late at your destination because it's very slow. Okay, so essentially routers are designed as fast path and slow path. And for most of the lecture today, the first and second lectures, we're just primarily going to be talking about the fast path. So fast path basically means all hardware. Okay, that's what it basically means. Okay, one of the key pieces of hardware after you have chosen where you want to go is the switching fabric. Switching fabric is a glorified bus. Okay, so remember what a bus does in a computer? It connects devices like input devices and so on, output devices, to the CPU. Okay, and the bus can also interface to memory, etc. So switching fabric connects ports to ports. Okay, so it's a glorified bus because a bus provides a single shared data path, whereas a switch provides multiple parallel data paths. That's the key idea. Okay, and a best switch, right, can provide so many paths that you'll never have blocking within the switch. In other words, if I have packets from 1 to M, and everybody has packets from 2 to M, everybody wants to send to M, right? I can make the interface hardware or output port hardware here to be N times as fast, right? It can be extremely fast, and the switch also offers parallel paths. So there'll be no contention at all, okay? In other words, there's no internal blocking, okay? Or there's no output blocking. Okay, so the switch design, you use the ideas of blocking, okay, and how many parallel paths, how much parallelism can you provide the switch? That's a major consideration. Okay, so the answer is very simple. Okay, if you want to provide lots of parallelism at very, very high speeds, cost is going to go up. Okay, brain dead. I don't know how to tell you this. Okay, so what is very fast has been changing over time. Okay, so it is, as I mentioned, today I can get a gigabit per second of switching capacity or aggregate capacity for $100, right? So whereas this was not available several years ago. Okay, so the desired switch fabric properties are: you want to have low cost, low overhead, and you want to support arbitrary number of ports. Okay, so and also there might be arbitrary degree of heterogeneity between the ports. It depends upon whether it's a edge router application or a core router application and so on. And you want to scale to arbitrary data rate. Okay, and by the way, one of the biggest complications in switches is that not only do you want to do unicast, you also want to do multicast. Okay, and potentially broadcast. Remember, Ethernet has to do broadcast, right? Layer 2 switches have to do broadcast. Okay, and there might be other I/O ports to be dealt with. So all these obviously you cannot achieve. Okay, so you have to trade off. If you want to achieve really high speeds, etc., and all the scalability stuff, so you got to pay high cost. Okay, whereas you can trade off, can provide some kind of a trade-off. Okay, and that's the challenge which you're going to basically study. Okay, I don't know what time we're doing. Okay, we'll just do this slide and then take a break, I guess. Okay, so the simplest sort of a switch, okay, even simpler than crossbar, is something known as a space division fabric. Okay, it's called a generic space division fabric. So essentially the idea is very simple. From every input port, provide a link to every output port, or provide a data path to every output port. Okay, this is like a full mesh. Remember, in topology we studied full mesh, right? Suppose these are all nodes and I want to provide interconnectivity, provide a direct link, right? That's what a full mesh does. So this is what you provide. If a switching fabric can provide you a full mesh of paths essentially these paths are what are known as spatial paths, in the sense that if I transmit on one path, it is possible for me to simultaneously transmit on any other path. For example, I could transmit on this path here simultaneously, or from this path here from the same interface simultaneously. Okay. Obviously, this starts to have some subtle implications, which means that the interface hardware here has to run extremely fast, right? Okay, and the interface hardware here also has to run extremely fast, and you also have lots of data paths to provide, right? So all of these immediately tend to be problems, right? You cannot have extremely high speed interface hardware, okay? The sort of costs dramatically shoot up, okay? Now, one thing which happens is that the first thing you can do is keep the number of paths internally high. Okay, you have no blocking internally, but then the interface hardware cannot keep up. Okay, so interface hardware can only choose any one of them, right? So suppose the output can only choose any one input and accept packets from only one input, such a problem is known as output blocking. Okay, the output, basically output blocking just means that output can't go fast enough. That's all it means. So similarly, I can have input blocking, saying that suppose you have multiple packets that show up here at really high speeds, but then I'm not able to shuttle them fast enough to these outputs, which means I need to buffer here. So this is input blocking. Okay. Now the other aspect is called internal blocking. So if the switch does not provide all these parallel paths, it might be possible that there might be one path which is shared between multiple input output pairs, right? That's what it means. Okay. So if any of the switch paths are shared, then you can have internal blocking. Okay. So the concept of blocking is whether you can think of it as port contention, and these fellows, either the hardware is not fast enough or the paths are not available. Okay. Something has to be shared and something cannot be fast enough. Okay. That is the idea of blocking. Okay. Okay. My red light is coming up. So what we'll do is we'll study how we can handle these blocking questions and how we can come up with several kinds of architectures to handle blocking. Okay, that's the next lecture. Thanks.